All right, today we are here to hear the case of Fleury versus IntraWest Winter Park Operations. Who is representing the petitioner, please?
Good morning, Chief Justice Rice. James Heckford on behalf of the petitioner, Selene Fleury.
All right, Mr. Heckford, thank you very much. And who's representing the respondent? All right, counsel, you each have 30 minutes. I think you can see the time just fine up there on the podium. So whenever you're ready, Mr. Heckberg, please go ahead.
Okay, please court, Chief Justice Glass. Court. Good morning. You know, Chief Justice Rice, as I walked in there, I was thinking that 20 years ago, I tried such a weak case in the lobby of the airport in Steamboat Springs, but I had never given an argument in a concert hall, and I think it's very nice, and I certainly would always respect it because it's a little overwhelming. Hopefully I'll be able to shake that off. We are here today to talk about the scope of the immunity provisions of the Ski Safety Act, and specifically whether the General Assembly intended that an avalanche on an open area within a ski resort should be included within the specifically defined conditions which are the inherent dangers in risks of skiing. And I think by necessity, that is probably also going to require that we talk about whether anyone other than the General Assembly is authorized to expand the conditions of the statutory list which make up the definitions of the inherent risk of skiing, which trigger the immunity provisions. Now, there has been disagreement among judges, and in fact, even justices, former justices of this court, as to what did the General Assembly mean, what did it intend when it placed that one word included preceding the statutory list of the defined inherent dangers and risks of skiing. Now when it did that, were they intending that what conditions followed would be an expansive list? Were there other conditions that maybe were unnamed or even unknown? That would be considered inherent dangers and risks of skiing that were not within the act, or was it the intent of the General Assembly that no, what follows this list, what follows this term included, are the exclusive inherent dangers and risks of skiing. Now, putting aside the legislative history that gets circled around during the hearings, how that word including became a part of that specific section of the act. Putting that aside, I think that if we just look at the nature of the statute that we're dealing with, what is the specific statute that we're dealing with, and what is the subject matter of that statute? What we're talking about is a statute here that is in derogation of the common law. And so what's the significance of that? Well, in the past, both historically and recently, when this court has a statute in front of it that is examined, that is in derogation of common law rights, that statute is really highly scrutinized. And in fact, it is scrutinized probably only to a lesser extent that this court scrutinizes the Constitution when it's examining the benefits of that. So here we have a statute that is in derogation of the common law, and specifically in a immunity statute. So when we look at that, the court in analyzing that says, okay, so we have the statute. The common law may be modified. It may be abrogated in two ways. It can be abrogated by this court. This court's the common law court, makes the rules of decision. And by the way, I'm not trying to talk down to the court. I'm trying to make it so the people behind me must understand. But this court being a common law court, they, of course, modify, extend, alter the common law, because this is where the common law originates. And we know that the legislature, by statute, and also by rule decision in this court, may also modify the common court, so the common law. So here we're looking at statute and derogation to common law, which this court will say must be strictly construed, and that this court will not infer derogation unless it's expressly stated or by unmistakable clear implication. We're not going to exchange the citizens' common laws. And so we have a vehicle of statute. So who may modify the statute? Can the court modify the statute? No, we're on the statute, Justice. The court may not modify the statute. It may confront the statute, but it may not add to the specific conditions that are found in the definition of the American English risk. Only the General Assembly may modify, add to, or subtract, if they want, those conditions. And so the court, in looking at the statute, says, I'm dealing with an application of common law right, the vehicle being used to modify that right is a statute. We have to interpret this statute strictly, which means we have to give literal interpretation to the words that are used. We have to look at the plain language of the statute, and we have to give that plain language its common meaning. Now, while we're allowed to interpret those words that go undefined, we certainly cannot go on or stand certain the conditions or events that are going to trigger a common law immunity. So in looking at the specific term of included, how are we going to follow this court? We're going to interpret that. Is it expansive so that there are other common, there are other dangers and risks out there? And I think if we look at the 1990 Declaration of Purpose of the General Assembly, when they placed the amendments which included the statutory definition.
Okay, and you were going to use included. So can I stop? You just used that term. So can you start instead with the purpose, can you start with your definition of included? Because I think the way you were just about to use it was included one provision. And so how what kind of meaning would you give it in that context versus the context of the statute?
Where I was going is that, and I don't know if I fully understand your question, but I was going to use the term included as when in the statutory declaration of purpose, or that we're talking about, we're here to say within the statute as a matter of law, that there are certain risks which are inherent dangers in this.
Right, but obviously it either means included is exclusive or included is, here are some examples. And I think you were about to use it as included. Here is an example of what the statute includes. And how is that, you're not arguing for that definition, are you, in the statute?
You know, my definition within the statute must be confined to, these are the exclusive conditions and principles for trigger immunity. Here's why I think the reason for that is only the General Assembly may, in this vehicle of the statute, may abrogate or excuse common law rights because we're using the vehicle of the statute. And so these are non-delegable responsibilities. As I'm talking to you, what comes into my mind is it's almost a separation of powers issue that the General Assembly legislates, and if it's going to open the common law to the statute, it is the only one. That's the only branch of the government. It cannot delegate either to this court or false fact. No, neither can it delegate to anyone else, such as the governor, to say, well, courts of Colorado, there may be other inherent dangers and risks floating around out there. Why don't you feel in the rights that we have broken? And it's our position that that's inappropriate because they are using the vehicle of sanction, only the General Assembly.
It sounds a little bit like you're making a really broad statement there. Let me make sure I understand it, that whenever the legislature passes a statute that would alter the common law, the word include always is exclusive?
Well, I think it depends on the context, certainly, Justice Stokes. But here, in the way that the included is used in this statute, it is different than when the General Assembly has used the word including or including but not limited to in other statutes. Because the only way that is this discourse rule, and it's also, I think, also inferred in CRS 2-4-112 about the allegation that the General Assembly has just come along, that only the General Assembly, it must expressly state, and it must state with clear language, that it is going to amend the common law. So when we're dealing with what Justice Hobbs called a control, a rule of controlling significance, I think that if there's an including which behind it triggers conditions or events that extinguish or that it triggers the immunity provision, yes, I think that at least in that context, you have to consider the word including as one that only the General Assembly may then say what triggers the immunity provisions.
Mr. Heckert, let me ask, make sure I'm understanding. So as you position, when you have an immunity statute, only the legislature gets to list what's immune, so they have to be specific. So in an immunity statute, including always means exclusive?
Well, I think certainly in the way that it is phrased in this particular statute, I guess you. I'm trying to think of an example where including, I think if you're going to say that the following conditions or events, or including these conditions or events, will trigger an immunity of a common law right of action, that has to be specific. And I think only the General Assembly, it cannot delegate that right or that obligation.
Well, I guess let me follow up. Why couldn't the General Assembly, or why couldn't you read the statute to say inherent risk of those dangers that are a part of the sport of skiing? That's what the legislature wants. Here are some examples, and you know we have this doctrine, iusdum generis, which says this is a list that gives you a sense of the kind of things we're talking about. Why can't we read the statute that way?
Well, I think the court can read the statute to interpret language and decide like conditions or like events. For example, there is, it says structures. An impact with a structure is an inherent danger and risk of skiing. So what is a structure? Okay, well, a structure may be a building. Obviously, a building is a structure. How about a grandstand that's there temporarily? I think the proper interpretation by the court is yes. We can interpret that condition as a structure equals a grandstand or picking it. How about snowmobile? Structure is not a snowmobile, isn't a structure. You never say, let's go jump in my structure and go get an ice cream. So the court certainly is allowed to interpret those words that the court is wrong. Not allowed to expand and bring in conditions or events which are not similar to those things that are stated, such as the snow conditions. It says that an inherent risk are the snow conditions of present or existing, such as powder, packed powder, ice, corn snow, very specific type of snow. Certainly, those are surface conditions. They don't say anything when they talk about subsurface conditions. They're talking about objects such as trees, stumps, rocks. When we pleaded in our complaint subsurface conditions, we were talking about subsurface snow, which was rotten, unstable, and known that it would slide. However, if you look at that category that the General Assembly placed there for subsurface conditions, doesn't say even measurement of snow. So certainly the court is permitted to expand within the likely conditions.
Let me stay there for a moment, Mr. Heckert, and just ask you why the provision to which you just referred isn't enough on its face to encompass this. When we talk about snow of all kinds, as it may exist or may change, isn't an avalanche really nothing more than just some kind of snow moving down a mountain?
That's a great question. An avalanche is in fact more, as even the amicus briefs show, that avalanche is in fact made up of slopes in excess of 30 degrees and a base that is unstable and weight placed on that. But when you just say, remember, Justice Scalia, we're talking here about skirt construction, plain language, and ordinary meaning. So just saying snow or snow conditions as they exist when they change, that doesn't mean nothing. And again, this is not significant for you. This is questionable as strict minimal construction.
So, and I didn't mean to cut you off, but if we take that reasoning to its logical conclusion, are we to understand that in the absence of the word avalanche, that there is no immunity for this kind of event?
Yes.
That's the bottom line.
That is the bottom line, because now look at what the Court of Appeals did. The Court of Appeals took three separately identifiable conditions, and then... They laminated those together to come up with a word that does not appear, which is avalanche. So we take changing weather conditions. And then they add to that snow conditions as they exist and when they change. And then add to that the variations in steepness, variations in terrain, and come out with the word avalanche. But keep in mind when you're thinking about when you're reviewing the Court of Appeals opinion, that you have to go back and say, did the General Assembly intend for us to take one condition here and one condition there and combine them together to come up with a word or an event that did not occur, is not reflected otherwise? And for you to arrive with all respect at that conclusion, you would have to believe that that was the intent of the General Assembly. Well, if that was the intent, why didn't you just say no? And in fact, this actually, the truth of the matter is, the bill was actually written by the ski industry. And certainly if they wanted to have avalanche there, they certainly would have had to put it in it. But when you have, if you're going to say that we can combine these conditions together, you have to reach the result that that was the intent of the General Assembly. Why didn't they just say avalanche rather than taking us on this contorted exercise of semantical geniuses? It's not, they can't create a statute in code language. It has to be expressed and it has to use some language. If it's a statute where you have to take out a code book to interpret it, that violates this court's rule of strict construction of plain language.
Good morning, Mr. Hackford. Let me stop you. In the legislative declaration, it says the General Assembly recognized that there are, quote, dangers that inhere in the sport of skiing, regardless of any and all reasonable safety measures which can be employed. Would that not apply to avalanches?
No, sir, it would not.
Okay.
Not generally, because, and this is a, and in fact, the Supreme Court of Utah has discussed this. Although it's not a part of their legislative declaration, when you talk about dangers that are moved to the sport of skiing, no matter what safety measures you are taking, that's talking about things that happen where if you are exercising your care, it's not going to happen. And here, with respect to an avalanche, all you have to, you know, avalanches occur in historically the same years. Don't have to use closed gear. While it may be that certain on-site mitigation of bombs or sea cutting, such as that, might not obviate the avalanches everywhere. You know where the avalanches are going to occur because they occur there historically, time after time after time. The ski area operators are thinking of the community where they occur.
So would we have to reach the conclusion that avalanches are predictable?
No, you don't have to do that, because when you talk about whether avalanches are predictable, we're talking about being in the area of avalanches in due care. We haven't even gotten that talk here. All we're talking about is, can we get into the courtroom door? Based upon the immunity statute, we can't even get in here and talk about what's the ski area of avalanches. That's a separate circumstance.
All right. Thank you.
In evaluating this at the outset, does it matter that we're talking about this trestle trees area that is, you know, expert extreme terrain off piece in the trees? Does that change the calculus at all along the lines of what Justice Boatwright was just asking?
No, it doesn't. Just sort of what. What it is that, and as the court set out in his issue, reclaim, is that it's 10 yards at this point. Now, of course, if the ski area operator wants to go and not perform any avalanche control or to close it, then whether or not it's expert or not, as long as it's in this open area.
So the danger that in here is the same for purpose of interpretation, bunny slope to expert slope, is that?
Certainly. And what I can't remember who it was that said that, well, that's going to happen is on expert slopes. And so those people don't know how to go into expert terrain. But I know in Steamboat Springs, where I live, that people think up there, they think they know something about skiing, but some of the most gradual trails there, they're called cash tracks. And you can go to the top of Mount Vernon, and if you're beginning to ski there, you can see on one of these green cash tracks. To get all the way down the bottom. It's a long run for beginning skiers. But what it does is it cuts right across the run called Lyot, which is one of the steepest. It's certainly a trail that is in excess of 30 degrees in pitch. And so if, for example, let's say that a negligent skier or employee goes on Lyot, knowing that it's been closed for avalanche conditions, and decides, oh, I'm going to ski this trail anyway. And it's on there, and then stays down an avalanche on a family of beginning skiers who are taking that green trail across it. They have been exposed to this risk. And so, if you're going to decide that an avalanche is an inherent danger and risk of skiing, you have to keep in mind that you are deciding that for all purposes, whether it's recklessness of the ski area operator, whether it's intentional conduct of the ski area operator, or whether it's negligence that. It's an inherent danger. They get immunity. I certainly don't agree that it's intended to generally assembly to give up that type of immunity. If they want to, can we pass something they can do on the court that like the legislature did in Montana, where they said that the avalanches are inherent dangers except on open sea trails. And I think they may have, although I was aware, and they have now said on green sea trails.
Mr. Eckert, may I ask you, I'm curious about how you read the regardless of any reasonable risk, reasonable safety measures and inherent risk. If reasonable safety measures can be employed, does that by definition make it not an inherent risk?
I don't think so. That's the conclusion that the Supreme Court came to in Utah, is that if reasonable safety measures may be employed, then it's not an inherent danger, because inherent dangers are those dangers which you cannot obviate by exercising due care. And I think that's a correct and a reasonable understanding of the language you come in.
So picking up then on Justice Boatwright's question, would it matter what the facts were? I suppose in this case you pled that there was some warning, that there was a high avalanche risk at this on this particular day. So is this turn on the factual basis? If you've pled that they were aware that there was a possible avalanche danger, they should have closed it, does that get you at least for pleading purposes past immunity, or is it a legal question?
I think that again, for immunity purposes, and whether it's subject to a motion to dismiss on the pleadings, that, again, the pleading, did they know or not? Well, I feel like that's to show that they did have knowledge and they knew or should have known, which would require them to plead. I think for immunity purposes, we don't get to that yet. I think you just decide whether or not an avalanche is an inherent danger risk in the area. Again, we're not talking about an area that is here and operates and closed. We're talking about an open area. And so I think that these issues of negligence and notice are not perfect.
Sure. Although that's kind of what I was asking, because the rule you're just suggesting we should enunciate is a very broad one. Avalanche in an open area is not an inherent risk, period. I mean, a narrower rule might be, an avalanche may or may not be an inherent risk, but if they're on notice, reasonable safety precautions could be taken, and therefore, it's not an inherent risk. Do you understand my question? It's a narrow rule.
I understand what you're trying to narrow this, but with all respect, Your Honor, I think that might be getting into an area where the court is legislative. And I think there you're going where only the General Assembly may go. The issue here is an element, if they would want to get that caveat like they did in Montana, where they said, well, I'm open skier, that might be fine. And I've been doing this long enough that I don't tell you just what to do and what not to do, because that's, you understand your job better than I do, but that's, you're asking my opinion, that's where I'm.
Thank you.
Perhaps one follow-up on that. On that same line of reasoning, you're giving the response about avalanches, would you say then that immunity attaches for injuries caused even by the things specifically listed, only if in addition it can be shown that something could not have been done to prevent the injury?
No, because that's not a part of what the General Assembly has created. Although that can be inferred from their from the legislative declaration, which said that the inherent dangers and risks are those that inherent absent them. So it can the court do as the court did it in Utah, so that you have that right interpretation.
So he, with that interpretation, even the list is not really, it's not only not an exclusive list, it's not even a list in and of itself of things that provide immunity. It's only if they also, if the injury were caused by one of these factors and it could not have been prevented by reasonable care.
That's the only way the court decides to make that decision, which is not the reason. And what I was saying is that the court can talk about that. With your permission, Chief Justice, I said I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Of course.
Operators pursue in recognition that skiing cannot be made safe. The petitioner takes the position that this case falls outside the scope of immunity because the word avalanche does not appear in the definition of inherent risk. The problem with this argument is threefold. First, the General Assembly did not endeavor to list all the inherent dangers, rather, it enacted a broad general definition, the scope of which it in fact expanded in 1990 and 2004. So it now encompasses all dangers that are part of the sport. Avalanches are dangers that are part of the sport that takes place in a high alpine mountain environment. Second, the general definition is followed by a non-exclusive list of examples. The alleged causes of the slide in this case: terrain, snow, and weather. They're all enumerated in the inherent risks. Third, the definition has three explicit exceptions. In essence, plaintiffs are asking this court to add another exception for when weather, snow, and terrain conditions result in snowslides. If the General Assembly had wanted to accept avalanches resulting from this snowfall on certain steep terrain from the scope of the inherent dangers and risks, they would have done so explicitly.
Let me just jump in right there, if I may, because the flip side of that, of course, is their argument, it was Judge Jones is in dissent, that why didn't they just list avalanches, inbounds as an inherent danger? Why didn't they do that expressly?
Well, for the same reason they didn't list cornices or safety cones or rubber mats or pumps, gullies and tree wells, all of which are inherent risk. Tree wells was conceded by the appellant, and all the others were found in U.S. District Court of 10th Circuit, which is a finding that's certainly persuasive.
What are those? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Justice.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, well, if this is such a pervasive condition or risk, why isn't it something that we would more expect to see listed then?
Well, because I think that what they listed were categories. Obviously, we're including it when Justice I, Justice Brooks, and Justice Gabriel brought that up with my esteemed calling Mr. Hepburn, including this clearly rural extension in the larger uniform in council. Presley, even in grading this court, has been basically uniform holding with respect to the meaning of that word.
Council,
so
can I just
basically grading categories.
Can I just jump just to have you follow up on that. How about, though, the argument that elsewhere the legislature has used, including but not limited to, or including, for example, where they've used different formulations elsewhere, not just the word including? Can you address that?
Yes, it's substantive meaning, okay. They're synonymous, and the choice is the informal contact accesses.
And Council, if I could pick up on that point, and correct me if I misremembered the record, but I thought there was an argument that in this particular section, the words "but not limited to" were actually stricken from an original version of the bill, contrary to other portions of the Act that include that entire phrase. Are we not to draw some sort of inference from that?
I don't think there's any ambiguity in the statute as written, Justice Marquez, and therefore we really don't need to resort to the office of this for the reason that you do. That was the 1990 amendment that legislative carries as a committee here. I don't think we can take that to be what we should be interpreting, what this clerk should be interpreting. We need to interpret the plain meaning and legislative intent of this bill, which does in the last year is from suit.
When you say no ambiguity, then are you responding to Justice Marcus that the word including can only be examples and can never be exclusive?
I certainly don't think it's exclusive in this situation when it's preceded by a broad definition. It says dangers and conditions that are part of exclusive.
And so would your argument be we can't go beyond the text because in context, the word including in the context of all of the text must be merely examples? I mean, you're making the argument that we cannot look beyond the text. Is that right?
No, I'm making the argument that including is there's just illustrative examples. It's a non-exhaustive list of inherent risks the legislature chose to put in there. And the three elements that cause an avalanche, which are all listed, changing weather conditions, snow conditions as they exist, and changes in variations and steepness of
course. Perhaps I'm not saying that well. I was thinking particularly of your response to Justice Marcus with regard to legislative history here or what language may have been stricken. I thought you were saying we shouldn't look to that because the statute's not ambiguous. But if including can mean either exclusive or examples, then is it ambiguous and shouldn't we be able to look and see what language was stricken and what happened in terms of legislative history?
Well, I think that what the appellants have been arguing in this case is it's ambiguous because it doesn't have the word avalanche. I think the actual list itself is unambiguous. I'm not sure if there's any other question as opposed
to let me ask this way then. Can the word including have more than one meaning?
I think it depends on context, Justice Rice.
So if it depends on context, where do we get that context?
I think you get that context from the general definition that precedes the word including. Dangers or conditions that are part of the sport of snowskiing. I think avalanches are inextricably part of the sport of snowskiing.
How is the word including different from the words such as?
So you
think that that
including is not limited to including, you know, such as in all sentences. If you look at Black's Law Dictionary, it says that.
Mr. Reitz, let me ask you, let's assume for a minute we would agree with what you just said. So what follows is a list of examples. Do you agree that whatever the risk would be would have to be of the same type, the Eustem generis rule?
Sure.
All right. So we listed changing weather conditions, or you said terrain, snow, and weather. Isn't an avalanche different? An avalanche is an event, isn't it? I mean, that's why is that a condition?
So are changing snow conditions. Yes, it exists when they change. Snow slides underfoot even when it's skiing. If you're skiing at half powder or powder, and you're on a steeper run, it'll slide underfoot. You can slide on ice. That's a dynamic.
You don't see a distinction between an icy patch on a slope and an avalanche?
I don't. I mean, a tree well, for instance, which is conceded by a petitioner, is basically snow that slumps in on top of someone when they go down into a head first. Near the trunk of a tree and undisturbed snow, and then they can die of asphyxiation from that. That's moving snow. I don't think it makes a difference whether the snow is moving inches or it's moving hundreds of yards. It's the same thing. Well, I think it's important to look at a brief history of the Ski Safety Act. The Ski Safety Act was first passed in 1979, and it laid out the respective responsibilities of the ski area operator and the skier. Due to the fact that litigation continued, some of which was frivolous, the legislature saw fit to actually create an inherent danger and risk to this to try to provide predictability because of the cost of litigation and the escalating insurance premiums. Then in 2004, after the Graven ruling, 10 years after the Graven ruling, we continued to see fact questions arise based on the danger sign requirement, based on the word integrate. Two of the factors that this court relied on the Graven ruling. Those were then removed in the 2004 amendment. So danger signs no longer exist as a requirement under the Act. We added extreme terrain in recognition that the skiers are now skiing steeper terrain than ever with new equipment, things like the X Games. I don't think that the legislature would have added extreme terrain if they wanted us to close everything over 30-degree pitch so that we don't have avalanches occurring, recognizing that avalanche control work is unpredictable. It's basically impossible to ensure that there won't be any inbound avalanche. I will say that there's been thousands of man hours doing avalanche control work, and for the most part, they've eliminated avalanches such that they're very rare occurrence. We've only had four. So I think that's admirable, but they cannot guarantee that, and that's why it's in here. That's why it's part of the legislative intent of the General Assembly. And this court observed in Stamp it's basically a broad immunity statute that the legislature passed in 2004 along with what existed before that. It's also undisputed that the plaintiff asserted in their complaint that the avalanche resulting in Mr. Norris's tragic death is caused by listed inherent conditions based on snow conditions as they exist and they change, changing weather conditions and durations and steepness of terrain. And those are specifically pled in the complaint. So I think it's important to note that in this case, an expert terrain in the trees, a natural occurring phenomenon took place, and a small avalanche took place in Mr. Norris. There was no active undertaking on the part of the security operator to do any work or anything that triggered here other than Mr. Norris probably seeing through the trestle trees.
So let me just ask about the reasonable safety measures piece. To what extent should that be featured in the holding? Should we say, if we were to agree with you, that given the reasonable safety measures employed here, an avalanche under these circumstances is simply an inherent danger? Or should it be that an avalanche is always an inherent danger and should separate out the reasonable safety measure piece? How would you craft that?
Well, I think in this case, it's easier, I think, because of the way the case was played and the circumstances are fact-handed and caused the tragic fatality. But I think that avalanches as a whole are inherent risks of the act. If you're going to start applying a fact question every time to the mitigation efforts that an area undertakes, whether it's marking, padding, digging, or avalanche control work, then every case is going to be a fact question and you're going to be frustrating the legislative intent. Providing predictability for the ski area operators and minimizing the pursuit when it has an adverse consequence of one of the mitigation risks.
Right, and if I can pick up right there, because if the rule that you would ask us to write here would grant immunity because avalanches are an inherent danger under any circumstance, is how I'm understanding your argument. And I'm trying to think about the consequences of such a ruling. What, in your view, what duties would the ski area have at all if they're actually immune from suit for avalanches?
Well, they may not have legal duties under that situation, but certainly they've been doing avalanche control work since the beginning of commercial ski resorts.
But you would agree then there would be literally no legal duty to do any kind of mitigation work or warning or closing off of the territory. There'd be no legal obligation to do that under such a rule.
Well, there is an obligation if you have a special use permit that was in our Forest Service office to have the avalanche control plan in place as part of a special use permit. The areas undertake all kinds of mitigation efforts that are required by the Act in favor of safety for their guests and enjoyment of their guests and their business.
And so
they're very, very conscientious about that. But if you're going to question that every time, then the grooming's going to be questioned. That was one of the problems prior to the 1990 amendment, was that the areas were getting criticized for, they didn't groom the ramp around the property, they were all areas. There was a tree that didn't line up with the tree line, it was a side yard. The conditions were less than desirable. And if you're going to break that question, you're going to remove all community reporting.
Well, I mean, those examples in my mind seem to go to whether the ski area was perhaps negligent in failing to do sufficient mitigation. What about a situation where there was recklessness on behalf of the ski area in triggering an avalanche? Under the rule that you would have us write, would the ski area likewise be immune, even where the avalanche may have been triggered recklessly for research reasons? So what? So how do we put that? How do we square those two?
Well, I think that can be easily reconciled, just like my guess. First of all, it's not an issue presented to this court in this case, as I pointed out. Second, there's no question that a natural occurring avalanche is an inherent danger in this under the present statute as it's worded. Hence, the plaintiff failed to state a claim in this case, and that's been our position all along. So you don't have to breach that question. But I would comment that merely alleging negligence is not contemplated by the Act. Negligence is addressed in 104, and negligence is defined for violating one or more of the statutory mandates under the Ski Safety Act. And that's where negligence comes from. Negligence, otherwise, the Act is silent on that. So otherwise, as I said, the immunity for a super would be non-existent. All a plaintiff's attorney's going to have to do is imagine to plead the case around the inherent risk or claim that there was something that could have been done to have prevented the accident, such as in the Clover Fund. Now, Clover is a Utah court. They have integral in their statute. It's an opposite of the law that we're dealing with in this state because that particular language isn't in there. So if this court's going to find that reasonable safety measures could have prevented an accident and therefore the inherent risk has been applicable, then the whole, you're frustrating the entire attempt of the act, in particular when it was supposed to create from
Sierra. Is the effect of that last statement you made about negligence and statute listing specific duties that will give rise to a negligence per se? Claim that by doing that, the legislature intended to abrogate any other duties and therefore any other common law negligence claim?
Well, actually, there isn't anything in the Act that creates negligence in another situation if, in fact, the accident occurs through one or more of the inherent dangers and risks. So it's silent on that.
And what's the effect of that? I think the way you're suggesting that is that has the effect then of the legislature intended to occupy the entire field, and therefore there could be no claim for negligence.
If it's an inherent danger in this.
Well, let me ask you then.
That's the key. There's certain things that could fall out of that. Suppose something falls, a chair falls off a lift or a brick fails or falls on a street. That would not be an inherent risk.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. I mean, is there? Can you give me other examples of what is not an inherent risk? All right, a chair falling off. Do you agree with Clover? And Clover was a blind. So you think the blind ski jump is an inherent risk?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, if there are blind transitions and breakovers of ski areas all over the state, every slope has breakovers and one degree or another. So there are blind spots where you lose your horizon. That's why 109 says that the skier has the duty to maintain proper lookout so as to be able to avoid other skiers and obstacles below. So it recognizes that by placing the burden on the skier, just as I think the legislature is placing the burden on the skier with respect to the inherent dangers and risks. And to find anything other than that is, I think, completely inapposite of the legislative intent in this particular section.
All right, so just to help me understand the breadth of what you're asking us to find, you cited one example, something not inherent risk, chair falls off on a skier. Could you give me some other examples?
I don't know. A piece of equipment fell on the trail, somebody's coming down, so that could be an inherent risk. It's created by the
You said it would be not an inherent risk, or did I miss that? Okay, thank you.
Powder is also an inherent risk, and we haven't discussed that at all. Powder is new snowfall. New snowfall was alleged as one of the causes of the avalanche that killed Mr. Norris.
Counsel, can I just stop you there? I mean, I think you started out your argument saying that including is just, here are some examples that you're reading of including. But then I hear you also maybe take the position that even if it is an exclusive list, avalanche is actually covered because there's snow and changing conditions. I mean, are you making both arguments, or?
I'm making the argument that I don't think including has to be an expansive term in order to define the avalanche as a part, because they are, as Judge Jones' question, I think indirectly comment, they're not intrinsically involved, they're part of the sport, which is much broader. They are intrinsic to the sport. They have been since the beginning of time for skiing. So, yeah, I think that you can find cases, you've got powder, you've got weather, you've got snow, and you've got terrain, all of which are the elements that cause the avalanche. It's just moving snow. Moving snow occurs every time you ski, to one degree or another, and particularly in powder, to have powder conditions. But I think listing powder is still another reason to find the avalanches were tending to be part of the very dangers of this alone.
Well, I guess I'm just trying to understand. So, I mean, from your perspective, we actually don't have to decide whether including is exclusive or by example, because under your argument, an avalanche falls within the listed examples.
Yes, okay. I agree. But I think it's wrong that it's including criticism. Word expansion part of the logic.
Okay, thank you.
Listed snow conditions. It's important to look at the different types of snow. Ice, hard pack, powder, pack powder, wind pack, corn, crust, slush, puff, snow, and distributed snow. It's the skiing and the interface with the different types of snow that can cause injury, which in turn impairs the sport. So if a skier comes over a breakover and encounters loose snow, which slides them, and the slide seriously injures them, isn't that the same as an avalanche? It's the interface with the snow that caused the avalanche in this case. I don't think there's any difference between the two. And I would encourage the court to see that that's their analysis. Use of the word including we pretty much covered. We've also covered the legislative history. I don't think that it's enlightening. In fact, Judge Jones said that in dissent, legislative history is not enlightening. Mother Nature is unpredictable. It's well documented in the authority cited by the plaintiff that avalanches both inbounds and outbounds are impossible to prevent. And in fact, petitioner says avalanches outbounds are an inherent risk. How can that be any different than avalanches being an inherent risk inbounds? Mother Nature doesn't recognize any such distinction.
Let's just stay on that point for just a second. I mean, when I go skiing, I certainly don't expect to get caught in an avalanche. I mean, it is different. And if there's a sign that says don't ski here because there might be an avalanche, I understand that to mean something different than if I'm just skiing in the area. I'm not concerned about there being an avalanche, where I might be concerned about there being bad snow or lack of visibility or a lot of those other things. It's qualitatively different, isn't it?
Well, first of all, there's absolutely nothing in the Act addressing expectations of skiers. The Act doesn't address that.
Well, let's just try to stick with my question. Isn't it qualitatively different when one goes to ski, you don't expect to be caught in an avalanche?
I don't think it is, Justice Rice, or Chief Justice Rice. I think that avalanches, first of all, I don't know what terrain you choose to ski on. That's a decision that each student makes individually. They're going to choose the terrain they're going to ski on and the snow conditions they're going to interface. And it's that kind of condition that can cause a myriad of different risks for them. And avalanches is one of them.
You can choose to ski on the terrain. I'm sorry to interrupt you on that third point, because as you walk through these various categories about snow conditions, weather conditions, terrain conditions, even blind curves or jumps, all of those in my mind seem to, and this ties back to Chief Justice Rice's question, conditions that the skier can, him or herself, readily perceive and then make an informed decision about, I can do this or I shouldn't, or maybe not today. But an avalanche, and I think this is what Chief Justice Rice may be getting at, seems to be qualitatively different. It's not something you can sort of assess conditions and then make an informed decision about, especially if it's a groomed run. So is it, help me understand how avalanche still fits those categories.
Well, first of all, I'm not aware of an avalanche ever occurring on a groomed run. The designated groomed green and blue trails, they don't occur. It's just not realistic. But there are all kinds of things that can happen to you out there that you're not going to expect. Somebody hits you from behind. A sudden gust of wind uncovers a rock outcropping and the skier hits it and it stops them in their tracks and they go forward to sustain a head injury. It's fatal. A whiteout condition. All of these things can occur very suddenly in this sport. You're doing this on the side of the mountains, the rugged environment. It's completely participant control as far as choice of speed and radius of turn, terrain, snow. I don't see avalanches as being any different from all of the avalanches. It's a natural current phenomenon, basically caused by Mother Nature, temperature, humidity, water density in the snow, wind, snowpack or the layers.
Well, I guess the question is if it really isn't any different, and it's your position, why didn't the legislature just say, or avalanche? Why do we have to create or build a construct from the statute to get where you want us to go?
Well, I think it's simple. I mean, they didn't list all changing weather conditions, high pressure.
But we have to put changing. We have to put changing weather together with snow conditions, together with terrain. I mean, we have to build a construct in order to create an avalanche. And so, why didn't the legislature just say, or avalanches?
Well, I think it was unnecessary, as all the elements of the avalanche were listed. And as I said, the legislature didn't endeavor to list all the dangers and perils. They couldn't possibly do that. It would have taken ages, and we still wouldn't cover all. They just created a lesser list. And the industry believed that they launched avalanches and inherent risk ever since the
You know, you keep wanting us to know what the industry does, and yet you don't want us to look at legislative history because you think this statute is clear and unambiguous. Which position are you taking?
Well, I'm taking that the legislative history is unnecessary, but I'm also taking the position that legislative history doesn't change things. It changed from including to including, but not limited to. It didn't change the meaning of including. And I think it's really important is the change taking integral out and using the general definition, dangers or conditions that are part of the sport. And I don't know how avalanche is going to be considered as such.
Mr. Reese, while you're taking a breath here, let me come back to the distinction you made between inbound skiing and backcountry. You said you don't see a distinction. And in backcountry skiing, as I understand it, and do correct me, there's no ski patrol out there. You just go ski on your own. Inbounds, you would anticipate that the ski patrol could say, you know, this area, trestle trees are dangerous today. The snow is soft, and stop it. And that comes back to the safety precautions that can be taken. Isn't that a distinction between inbounds and backcountry?
Sure. And that is the distinction. Is that the reason they take extensive mitigation efforts to try to prevent them, but they're not always successful.
Sure. So how does that fit together then? When we talk the reasonable precautions language, is coming back to what Justice Hood asked you earlier in your argument. How do we read the reasonable safety precautions together with inherent risk in your mind?
Well, I think that the areas are going to undertake those regardless of the purpose.
So, I don't think that, with all respect, I'm not sure that's responsive. I understand that they will do that. God bless the ski patrols, but you know, in terms of statutory interpretation, how do we fit those two things together?
You're talking, let me see if I understand your question. Your question is how do we distinguish between the fact that the avalanche controls that inbound and not?
No, I'm talking about the reasonable safety measures. The legislative declaration says dangers that inhere in the sport of skiing regardless of any and all reasonable safety measures. So, I mean, one way to read that would be if reasonable safety measures can be employed, it is not by definition inherent risk. That's just an example. You could read it that way. I'm curious how you would put those two things together.
Well, I think if you're going to put that together with creating a fact question in the case of the area, if it had done something like the Clover Utah court, ruling, then you're not going to be nice near it, because every case is going to be a question for the agency.
All right, so how would you read it?
I would read that meaning that the legislation recognized that there are sports, there are injuries and dangers that impair the sport regardless of reasonable safety measures. And the legislation is assuming that there's taken out of reasonable safety measures.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Maybe there are quick changes in the snow pack as they exist when they change, which is one of the inherent dangers in this. And those are directly on point. And they're going to be meaningless if you don't apply them to avalanche, because they're categories. They have to be categories, otherwise they wouldn't apply under any circumstances. Weather and snow change day to day, hour to hour, and minute to minute. An area that's safe at 7 a.m. can avalanche or slide at 9 a.m. Mother Nature controls snow conditions and changing weather conditions, and avalanches occur in consequence. These, as well as the rest of the list of inherent danger risks, are clearly illustrative and intended to cover the myriad of risks that each skier faces when they go skiing. And that's how they're completely embraced by the plain meaning of the intent of General Assembly in 33.40335. There's three exclusions, and we haven't really covered that, but they're provided. Collisions with skiers, lift-related accidents, and violations of the act. As I said earlier, if the legislature had chosen not to have avalanches in their inherent danger risk, they would have done so with another exclusion, and they did not do so. Otherwise, those exclusions are null. If the list, if they have no meaning, they'll be exclusions, because it's an exclusive list. So that's going to lead to completely illogical result. And I would add that the inclusion of three specific exclusions to the inheritance means there are no other exclusions. The legislature could have addressed that and chose not to. It also must be remembered that expert skiers go on steep terrain. They're either black diamond or double black diamond extreme terrain. Lower level skiers on green and blue runs are not at risk. Avalanches only occur on pitches over 30 degrees.
I think your time is just about up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Heckbert, you've got a little time left. Looks like about 4.5 minutes. So.
Start with one thing when my colleague was talking about that in 2004, the legislature removed the word "injury," and that is significant. Well, I started thinking about that, and I went to the dictionary and I looked up the definition of "parent," and then I looked up the definition of "integral," and it means the same thing. There's students. So when "integral" was a part of this section, the section that it inherent dangers and risks of skiing. Are those dangers, dangers, and risks that are inherent to sort of skiing? Well, that's a circular sentence that really doesn't say anything, and I think probably teachers in English composition here would probably flunk the General Assembly on that statement. Or in deference to our General Assembly, they took that language from Utah. And when my friend Desmond Reed says that we shouldn't pay attention to Utah law, well, our law came from Utah. And so when they removed the word "inherent," all they did was remove the word "inherent" because there was a circular sentence. I don't think that is a word of significance, because if you look up all those words, they go up in fundamental, essential, basic. Inherent means integral, and integral means inherent. So I don't think that the inherent dangers in this scheme become less inherent by removing the word "inherent." Mr. Reese did not want to talk about the legislative history. Now they are running from the legislative history because when in 1990, when they were trying to persuade the General Assembly to enact this, they were telling the General Assembly, both a representative of Guinness and the representatives of Colorado USA, were saying this. Inherent dangers and risks are not that easy. You can see them. You expect it. Not only that, if you see under control, you can avoid them.
And Council, I know you're out of the, but I really want you to address tree wells. Because I think your opponent's argument is that a tree well basically is something you can't see, you're not going to anticipate it, but it could happen to you in an instant, and it's a mini avalanche.
It's not.
Okay.
You see a tree well?
I can't see a tree well.
It's a terrifying experience. But you can see, you know, when you can encounter that there is going to be a tree well. And a tree well is a variation in the terrain. We agree with that. I know that. And it's something that you can see. When you're going to encounter, and that's when you're going to run into a tree well, you know to avoid it. So I would disagree that it's something that the happens right there. And the other thing, Mr. Justice, is you can expect Colorado State Concrete, when they were arguing along with Representative Gass, you can expect these. Really making a difference. They also took out the word which and replaced it with that. You call the word the CFS which, and that's just a grand push you have to use that from the beginning. I'm talking about it also passes by a good few weeks that pay no attention to the what was said at the hearing. Well, Justice Coates has said on several occasions that the comments of the sponsors are what he referred to as all the letters of the purpose and the intent of the statute. So I would suggest that you do look at that. Justice Coates also talked about when he talked about removal of the word enemy. Justice Coates says, well, if we're dealing with a statute that is unambiguous, then maybe we should, we can infer that the change in the statute is not going to change the law. However, signing several he said that if we're dealing with a section of the law that is
All right, thanks very much, Council. We appreciate your arguments, Mr. Heckbert. Mr. Reeves, we appreciate them. And court will be in recess. And Council, I appreciate you answering questions from the students for just a short while. Thank you very much.